I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC, 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. This is Democracy Now!
There is a potential for a much stronger escalation, and that is what concerns me. The possibility of transforming Lebanon in another Gaza, which I think would be a devastating tragedy for the world.
Monday's death toll from Israel's massive aerial bombardment of Lebanon has risen to over 550 people, including over 50 children. The deadliest single day in Lebanon in nearly two decades. Tens of thousands of civilians are displaced, now sleeping in schools and makeshift shelters. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Then, as world leaders gather here in New York to address the UN General Assembly, activists kick off Climate Week with a direct action to shut down Citibank. There were 31 arrests. Citibank, one of the largest funders of fossil fuel expansion.
We are here to shut it down during Climate Week because we know a better future is possible. We do not need to be investing in fossil fuels.
We'll hear voices from the streets and speak to Kumi Naidu, former head of Greenpeace International and Amnesty International, now president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. And unless the U.S. Supreme Court intervenes today, the state of Missouri is set to kill Marcellus Williams tonight, despite the fact the prosecutor, the jurors, and the murder victim's family all oppose his execution. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati has accused Israel of waging a war of extermination after Israeli airstrikes killed at least 558 people, including 50 children, and injured over 1,800 since Monday. It was Israel's largest attack on Lebanon in nearly two decades. In Israel, Israel said today it will further accelerate its attacks on Lebanon. Israel claimed the airstrikes struck 1,600 Hezbollah targets, but Lebanon's health ministry said Israel mostly struck civilian sites, including hospitals, medical centers, and ambulances. Thousands of Lebanese residents have fled southern Lebanon, with many heading to Beirut. The UN Human Rights Office warned Israel that sending a warning before attacking civilians is not okay. Hezbollah forces responded to Israel's massive attack by firing missiles at Israeli military bases, arms factories, and other areas. EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell warned, quote, "We are almost in a full-fledged war," while UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric said the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is alarmed at the large number of civilian casualties reported in Lebanon.
The message to the parties that are firing at each other across the blue line, to all the parties involved in this conflict, is step back from the brink. Stop the escalation. As we just said, there is no military solution at this point that will make anyone in either country any safer.
Israel's attack on Lebanon also killed at least one journalist. Hadi El-Sayed, a reporter for Al-Mayadeen, died after Israel bombed his home in southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, the Pentagon's announced more U.S. troops would be sent to the Middle East. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on Israel to stop attacking schools in Gaza that provide shelter to displaced Palestinians. Over the past 3 days, Israeli attacks on schools have killed at least 32 Palestinians, including 16 children. The UN agency said, quote, the children of Gaza have already lost schools as a place of education. Now they're being killed in schools as they seek shelter. On Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Mustafa spoke at the United Nations.
As I speak to you, before you, our people in Gaza are enduring one of the darkest chapters in modern history. For nearly a year now, Israel's genocidal war has caused unprecedented loss and suffering and humanitarian catastrophe. At the same time, our people in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, continue to face systemic threats driven by escalating settlers' violence, military raids, movement restrictions, and financial siege, withholding of Palestinian tax revenues.
ProPublica has revealed USAID and the State Department's Refugees Bureau both concluded this spring that Israel had deliberately blocked deliveries of food and medicine into Gaza. But U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other top Biden officials rejected the findings of their own agencies, the two foremost U.S. authorities on humanitarian assistance. Blinken's decision allowed the U.S. to keep sending arms to Israel. Under U.S. law, the government's required to cut off weapon shipments to countries preventing the delivery of U.S.-backed aid. U.S. prosecutors have announced plans to bring attempted assassination charges against Ryan Ruth, the man accused of trying to kill Donald Trump while he was playing golf in Florida. The charge carries a life sentence if convicted. Prosecutors revealed Ruth wrote a letter months ago detailing his plans to kill the former president. The state of Missouri scheduled to execute Marcellus Williams this evening, despite significant indications he was wrongfully convicted. On Monday, Missouri Supreme Court and the governor, Mike Parson, declined to halt the scheduled killing, even though St. Louis's top prosecutor, Wesley Bell, said in a January filing that, quote, new evidence suggests that Mr. Williams is actually innocent, unquote. The prosecutor, the jurors, and the murder victim's family are all against the execution. DNA found on the murder weapon did not match Williams, but instead matched another man. Williams, who's African-American, was convicted in 2001 of killing former St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporter Leisha Gale, who was white, during a robbery. He was convicted by 11 white jurors and one black juror after the prosecution was allowed to preemptively strike out six other prospective black jurors. Last week, Democratic Congressmember Cori Bush spoke about the case on the House floor.
I am urging Governor Parson not to let another innocent man be murdered at the hands of the state. He must heed this call. And as a proud co-sponsor of the Federal Death Penalty Prohibition Act, Congress must also act. Let's end this racist, this flawed and inhumane practice once and for all. Save the life of this innocent man.
Only the U.S. Supreme Court can intervene today to stop Marcellus Williams' execution. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Climate activists disrupted a speech yesterday by President Biden's climate advisor, Ali Zaidi, during an official Climate Week NYC event. Two protesters held up a banner reading, Off Fossil Fuels, Free Palestine, as they took the stage.
Necessary to have
the Biden and Harris campaign cannot continue to fund and subsidize and approve new fossil fuel projects. They also have to stop funding Israel and the Pentagon, who are continuing to carry out the genocide of the Palestinian people.
And nearby, at Citibank's headquarters in Manhattan, police arrested 31 activists as they blocked the building's entrance and demanded it stop funding fossil fuel projects. Protesters also called for world leaders gathering at the UN General Assembly to put people over profits and end the war on Gaza. Democracy Now! Is there. We'll play voices from that action later in the broadcast. In related news, prominent climate activist Greta Thunberg has joined demands to boycott Chevron over its supplying of energy to Israel.
In Palestine and all over the world, the fight against colonialism and corporations' destruction of the planet are intrinsically linked. Look at Chevron. Everyone knows that Chevron is one of the world's biggest climate criminals. But the oil giant is also fueling Israel's genocide in Palestine.
In California, activists with Sunrise Movement gathered outside Kamala Harris's Los Angeles home demanding the Democratic presidential nominee take serious action on the climate. The protesters brought with them a couch that had been burnt down to its frame in a nearby wildfire. In response, Harris posted on X she will, quote, tackle the climate crisis with bold action to build a clean energy economy, advance environmental justice, and increase resilience to climate disasters, unquote, but did not lay out any specifics, as climate activists have been demanding. In more news from California, the state's attorney general, Rob Bonta, announced California is suing ExxonMobil for lying to the public about plastics being recyclable.
The truth here is that this myth of recycling, this decades-long campaign of deception, has led to and exacerbated the global plastics pollution crisis. And while plastics are not actually being recycled, the one thing that ExxonMobil does recycle is its lies.
President Biden Monday designated the United Arab Emirates a major defense partner as the U.S. seeks to deepen military cooperation in the Middle East, East Africa, and Indian Ocean regions. The White House said in a statement this would facilitate joint training, exercises, and military-to-military collaboration between the U.S. and UAE armed forces. The UAE is only the second nation to receive such designation after India. The announcement came as Biden met with UAE President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, and despite mounting concerns over the UAE's backing of Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, which has been accused of massive rights abuses, along with the Sudanese military and Sudan's devastating civil war. France has sent a long-banned riot police force to the Caribbean island of Martinique amid mounting protests over the cost of living and inequality. Martinique, which has a majority black population, has been colonized by France since the 17th century. Residents of Martinique pay an estimated 30% to 40% more for food than residents of France. White and French residents of Martinique also hold outsized political and economic power. And in Senegal, authorities have recovered the remains of at least 30 people on a boat off the coast of Dakar. The boat was likely adrift at sea for days. Senegal's become part of a common route for the increasing number of refugees being forced to flee West Africa due to conflict, extreme poverty, and other dire conditions. Most migrants who depart from the region are attempting to reach Spain's Canary Islands as they hope to resettle in Europe. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The Israeli military says it carried out another airstrike on Beirut today in a southern suburb of the city. This comes as the death toll from Israel's massive aerial bombardment of Lebanon Monday rose to at least 558 people, including over 50 children and over 40 women. More than 1,600 people have been injured. It marked the highest single-day death toll on Lebanon in nearly two decades. Tens of thousands of civilians have been forced from their homes in southern Lebanon in the largest exodus since the 2006 war. Many displaced families are sleeping in makeshift shelters set up in schools in Beirut and other cities. Some 500 people have even crossed into Syria to seek safety, according to Agence France-Presse. Israel claimed the airstrike struck 1,600 Hezbollah targets, but Lebanon's health ministry said Israel also struck hospitals, medical centers, and ambulances. Hezbollah forces responded to Israel's massive attack by firing missiles at Israeli military bases, arms factories, and other areas. Satellite data analyzed by Associated Press showed the wide range of Israeli airstrikes aimed at southern Lebanon, covering an area of over 650 square miles. The aerial bombardment comes as Lebanon is still reeling from last week's attack by Israel, when thousands of electronic communication devices, from walkie-talkies to pagers, exploded at the same time across Lebanon, killing 390 people and wounding nearly 3,000. From where we go to Beirut, where we're joined by Michelle Eid, editor-in-chief of Arawiya, a digital magazine covering the Levant. She joins us from Beirut. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you describe what's happening on the ground now in Lebanon with this largest single-day death toll in almost 20 years, the massive flight of Lebanese from the south moving towards Beirut? Michelle.
Hi. First of all, thanks for having me. Essentially, what's happening now is a massive exodus from the south. Many people are displaced. They're trying to find a safe haven. And as a result, the roads are jammed. There's an oncoming fuel crisis as well, because people are trying to fill their tanks. And so many people have been stuck on the road for hours on end, trying to reach somewhere safe. And as people were exiting South Lebanon and going on the road towards Beirut, there were airstrikes falling near them, around them. So you can imagine it's a very panic-filled scene. And around Lebanon, so what's happening at the moment is these individuals who are displaced from the south are trying to find safe havens in schools and different shelters all across Lebanon, whether it be the north, Baqa, Mount Lebanon, and people are going, trying to help them, trying to find any basic necessities that they can help them with, provide them with food, with water, with medicine, with sleeping bags so they can sleep. So you can imagine the situation is quite dire at the moment.
And Michelle, these bombing attacks have occurred not just in the south, but also in some northern sections of Lebanon as well. So how are the civilians supposed to know even where to go?
You know, the way that I can describe this is they think about the immediate solution. So once they're bombing the south, people are leaving the south. When they bomb Baqa, they try to find another safe place in Baqa. They don't have the luxury of thinking long term. They don't have the luxury of thinking where would be the safest place for me to be now, especially with the crowding. You can say because there are a lot of people who are trying to find these shelters, who are trying to find apartments. So there's an overflow of demand and maybe not enough supply, or rather, let me fix that. There is supply, but there is also some sort of exploitation of the people who are being displaced from the south. So landlords, for example, there is not a lot of, you can say, give and take when it comes to rent. And so many families find themselves unable to rent an apartment with their children, with their elderly parents, with their members of the family that have special needs or special medical requirements.
And this comes, these attacks come in a situation where Lebanon has already had a long-term economic crisis. Could you talk about the situation in the country as a whole?
You know, prior to the war, the country has already been suffering. It's been suffering since 2019 with the financial collapse. Then after that, with the coronavirus. So public institutions are not able to support the community, the Lebanese population properly, or all communities that live within Lebanon. And so once the war began in October, there was, you know, panic amongst people in the community, in the Lebanese communities, about whether Lebanon would be able to sustain a war, whether the medical sector would be able to sustain the war, whether, you know, directorates that are responsible for food security are able to, whether gas and energy directorates are able to as well. Lebanon is not properly equipped to be able to sustain such a war. And it was not properly equipped to function even ever so normally prior to the war in its normal situation. So as you can imagine, there is panic across not only members of you know, the public, but also people who are in public institutions as well.
Michelle, you're speaking to us from Beirut, so your own family has to be impacted by this. Can you describe both what you've talked about, the chaos yes. in the streets, what has happened to your family in the south, and what these phone calls mean? The Israel is saying they've sent out tens of thousands of calls. Apparently, Lebanon's Minister of Information got one of these warning calls. The UN Human Rights Office warned Israel sending a warning before attacking civilians is not acceptable.
I can talk about maybe my family first. So I have family living in the south and Bekaa as well. And on a personal level, for the past 2 days, it has been havoc, trying to be able to reach them to make sure that they are okay. My maternal great uncle is stuck in the south because of the situation on the roads. He didn't want to leave the south at first either, because the concept of leaving his home is already painful enough, because this is not the first time the south witnesses such aggression, you know? And so it's been just panic mode on a personal level to be able to try and get my family to safety, especially with data not being able, not being proper as well, not having good connections, so we can't reach them all the time. So as you can imagine, even my family living abroad, they're also in this state of panic, trying to reach their family members here as well. So on an internal level, it's been a mess. And then going on to people receiving texts and phone calls. So dozens, hundreds, maybe thousands of individuals yesterday received either phone calls or texts telling them to evacuate their buildings because they do have some either Hezbollah weapons or Hezbollah personnel in these buildings. And they gave them either a time frame to leave or with no time frame at all. So these individuals, not even knowing, you know, they haven't had time to think of a plan B or a plan C. They had to grab their stuff and just leave their homes, try to find some safe haven, whether near or far. And these people who were conducting these phone calls, for example, the phone calls, they were coming from Lebanese numbers, but the individuals who were doing the calling spoke in formal Arabic, which is very different than our colloquial language, our mostly used language, our informal language. And so, as you can imagine, this induces quite the scary scenario for many people who are also unable to leave right away, who have members of their family who need special support, whether it be a physical disability, a mental disability of the sorts. So it's been quite hard on these families who were across Bekaa, across the south, and even in some suburbs in Beirut.
Michelle Ayed is editor-in-chief of Al Rawaya. She's speaking to us from Beirut. And in our New York studio, we're joined by Lina Munzer, Lebanese writer, translator, senior editor of the arts and literature magazine, The Markaz Review. Her new piece for Middle East Eye is headlined, Israel's War on Lebanon, the trauma of watching the Hollywood movie from afar. Start off with what just has happened in the last 24 hours. Worst single lethal day, deadly day for Lebanon in nearly 20 years, with over 558 people dead, 50 of them children. Your response, looking at all of this from New York.
First, hi, Amy. Thanks for having me here. Honestly, it's very shocking looking at it. The speed with which everything is happening, the death toll, as you said, it's actually at this point, I think it's fully half the amount of casualties that we saw in the 33 days of the 2006 war between Israel and Lebanon, or I should say the assault on Lebanon in 2006. So within one day, we're seeing a huge amount of casualties. And at the same time, we're seeing all of the tactics that they have been using in Gaza. They're kind of speed running what has been happening in Gaza. They've been bombing ambulances, pathways to hospitals. As Michelle was just talking about, they've been asking people to evacuate, but really it is flee. They're, you know, making people panic. And then they're also bombing the roads out, the bridges. People are terrified. It's very difficult for them to find their way out. And it's really, you know, it's, I just left Beirut. I've been there, you know, I live there normally. And I left Beirut a few weeks ago. And knowing that there was a possibility that things would escalate while I was gone, but truly the speed with which this has happened has been incredibly shocking. And, you know, just between one night and the next to wake up and to see full-blown war and this level of casualties and carnage is just, it's just absolutely terrifying. So, you know, my initial reaction really is one of shock, even though I feel we should have been inured watching what's been happening in Gaza over the period of an entire year. We shouldn't be shocked anymore, but still, it is absolutely shocking.
And Lena, I wanted to ask you about the coverage of the media coverage in the United States and Europe on this, because it's clear, number one, that these pager and walkie-talkie attacks were sheer terrorism on the part of Israel, and that this is a naked escalation of the war on Israel's part. Yet that's not the way it's being portrayed. Rather, they're concentrating on the technological sophistication of Israel and being able to use these pagers and these walkie-talkies to attack Hezbollah.
Yes, Juan, absolutely. I mean, basically what we've been seeing from the beginning of the assault on Gaza as well is the media has been, you know, we use the word complicit, but what does that really mean? I mean, the media has been actively helping manufacture consent for what has been happening, allowing people to not just to be complacent, but to feel that whatever is happening in Gaza, in Lebanon, is well-deserved. You know, this is Israel's counterterrorism. This is Israel defending itself, quote-unquote. And people have bought that to the extent that now Israel can come up with whatever flimsy excuse. You know, one of the things that they've been saying now is that they are bombing locations in the south because Hezbollah uses people's homes to hide rocket launchers. And so any civilian casualties incurred are part of this counterterrorism. And so for me, the pager attack and the way that it was covered is really only just a small part of all of the way that Israel's attacks have been are being covered. You know, whether it's by the fact that they continue to repeat the lies about, you know, burned, raped, mutilated, beheaded babies. If you notice, every single time an Israeli spokesperson speaks, they will never, you know, when they talk about the attacks, they will always, you know, it's like they've been given this directive to use all of these, like, to use this particular language that's very incendiary and to remind people of, you know, burned, beheaded, etc. And no one calls them out on it, even though there is no evidence of any of these things actually, you know, having taken place. And so it was very shocking to me, you know, if this pager attack had happened anywhere else. And we keep saying that, which I think it's actually quite sad that we have to keep saying, imagine this happened to you, or imagine it happened in any other country. What would you think about it in that way? You know, it's this constant feeling of having to remind people that, you know, we are equally as human as anybody else. But truly, I mean, what you had was you had a series of small explosions going off against the intimacy of people's bodies across the entire country. And it was, everybody was in a, it is the absolute definition of terrorism. People were terrified. People were afraid of the electronic devices in their own homes. And yet, you know, you have people covering this as though it were a marvel. I mean, even I saw an opinion piece in the New York Times the other day that began with, even though we're all amazed by this, even though we all think it's such an incredible thing, you know, technological feat that Israel pulled off, we still must admit that this is an act of terrorism. So even if somebody uses those words, it's always couched within within a kind of inherent excuse. And it's frankly sickening. I mean, yes.
It's quite something to, for example, hear Leon Panetta, the former CIA director, the former defense secretary, saying that the blowing up of pagers and walkie-talkies is terrorism. So he is describing it in that way, you know, represents the establishment in the United States. And, of course, you hear Biden and Blinken decrying the fact that there isn't a ceasefire. But at the same time, we bring you this report today from ProPublica, just one of many different reports, that says USAID and the State Department's Refugee Bureau, and this has to do with Gaza, and you make serious links like saying Israel's speed-running the Gaza playbook. ProPublica's revealed USAID and State Department's Refugee Bureau both concluded this spring that Israel had deliberately blocked deliveries of food and medicine into Gaza, but Secretary of State Blinken and other top Biden officials rejected the findings of the agencies, the two foremost U.S. authorities on humanitarian assistance. That decision allowed the U.S. to keep sending arms to Israel, because under U.S. law, the government's required to cut off weapon shipments to countries that prevent the delivery of U.S.-backed aid. And I wanted to bring that to the end of your piece, where you quote a Lebanese friend who's been living in the U.S. for a while, saying, I'm either in the flames or I'm in the place that's lighting the fire. Can you talk about the U.S. role in what's happening in your country, Lebanon, and Gaza?
I mean, the United States is, you know, there's always these debates about who is wagging the dog, let's say, you know, this idea of like who is truly in control. Is it Israel or is it the United States? For me, they are one and the same. Israel seems to be kind of like a colonial outpost of the United States, and I feel that their interests are very much aligned. And so the United States continues to say that it is not interested in a regional war. It is not interested in a conflagration. At the same time, they have been running cover for what Israel has been doing in Gaza for an entire year. And honestly, since pretty much October 8th, we could see that this day was coming. We could see that so long as the war continued in Gaza, as long as the assault on Gaza continued, that this was eventually going to come and engulf Lebanon. And, you know, once Lebanon goes up in flames, it's also very likely that the entire region goes up in flames. And so the United States can say all they like that they are, you know, looking at the possibility of a ceasefire, that they don't want for there to be a regional war. But the way that they have been doing things is, you know, frankly says otherwise, including and up to the fact that every single time that, you know, there's something that Israel needs to be called out on, we see them running interference for Israel. You know, all the State Department spokespeople refuse to comment. They will not allow journalists to ask them any questions, and they will deflect constantly. And so, I mean, the United States is firmly partnered, you know, as they keep saying, they say, you know, we're looking to our partners in Israel. That's exactly what they mean. They're partners in Israel. They are partners in crime. And they truly are one in the same. It's very difficult, honestly, to separate between the two, the United States and Israel at this point.
And Lena, I wanted to ask you about the timing of this escalation by the Netanyahu government, because those of us who have followed the conflict in the Middle East for decades know that Israel almost always uses the period before a presidential election or sometimes after the election, before a new government is sworn in, to launch its fiercest attacks, precisely because it knows that the administration in power, given the volatility of U.S. elections, is reluctant to take any action to even mildly criticize Israel. Wondering what your thoughts about the timing of this escalation.
I mean, I think you're absolutely correct. And yet, at the same time, because we have seen absolutely no change in the U.S. administration, the Biden administration has been absolutely gung-ho, 100% behind Israel. You know, so they have the full support. So it's not, it doesn't seem to me like this is going to, that the United States is at any point was even threatening to withdraw full support from what's happening. So yes, the timing is before the election. And at the same time, you know, it's been going on for so long at this point that I don't even know what the election has to do with it anymore. It's just, it feels like the United States is busy right now with its own, you know, with the elections and what's happening there. And Israel is just free to run rampage, you know, all over Gaza, all over Lebanon. So it is related to the United States elections, and yet at the same time, I really cannot see how it's going to make any difference whether it's Harris or Trump or Biden in power, frankly, at this stage. It seems like it's just running on autopilot, this war, at this point.
Lena Munzad, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Lebanese writer, translator, senior editor of the arts and literature magazine, The Markaz Review. We'll link to your piece in Middle East Eye, headlined Israel's War on Lebanon, the Trauma of Watching the Hollywood Movie from Afar. Next up, Climate Week is underway here in New York. 31 activists were arrested trying to shut down Citibank headquarters yesterday. Democracy Now! Was there. We'll also speak with Kumi Naidu, former head of Greenpeace and Amnesty, now president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative, in from South Africa. Stay with us.
محمد نشتاق الأهل ورفقاته بيحي السلم متهن اشتاقت عينه لتراباته العيون نامت لكن صاحي قلبه ما بينام
يا رايح صوب بلادي دخلك وصل السلام بيض أهلي ولادي مشتاق له رب الحمام سلم
The One Going Towards My Land by Ahmed Kabour. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We turn to Climate Week, which has brought thousands of government leaders, scientists, companies and activists to New York City alongside the United Nations General Assembly. Activists began the week Monday with a direct action shutting down one of the world's largest funders of fossil fuel expansion. Democracy Now! Was outside Citibank's global headquarters in Manhattan when 31 activists were arrested for blocking the building entrance after the company ignored their repeated requests for a meeting. Many spoke about the devastating impacts of Citibank's fossil fuel investments on their communities in states like Louisiana and Texas.
Hey, city, get off it. The planet over profit. Hey, city, get off it. The planet over profit. Hey, city, get off it. The planet over profit.
Stay in front. Stay in front. Jonathan Weston with Climate Defenders. Cities financing the entire destruction of the Gulf South, and families from the Gulf South came up here to meet with them today, and city refused to meet with them.
My name is Melanie. I work for Strong Economy for All here in New York. We are here to shut it down during Climate Week because we know a better future is possible. We do not need to be investing in fossil fuels. The time is now for renewable energy, and we are demanding Citibank hear us.
Are you willing to get arrested for that?
Yes, I am willing to get arrested today because I believe in a better future than what Citibank is financing every single day. Cheryl Barnes, I'm definitely willing to be arrested. Citibank refuses to meet with us. They are responsible for ecocide and genocide all over the world.
Charged with additional crimes.
Please welcome Bill McKibben.
This is towards the end of this remarkable summer of heat. More than 1,000 of us have gone to jail so far this summer. And the reason is because this building behind us, this is the headquarters of the largest funder of fossil fuel expansion on planet Earth. If there is a flood near you, if there is a fire near you, if you can't grow food anymore where you used to, if you're having to leave your home because the ocean is rising, if you're living through some heat wave where the temperature is going to 120 degrees, this building is a big reason why.
My name is Camille Oze, and I'm traveling here from Southwest Louisiana. I have to come all the way out here just to fight for clean air in my communities. Every day, I have to pass by plant industries that give me really bad headaches and that smell really bad. I don't want to have to do that. I'm only in middle school. I shouldn't have to worry about what my plant is going to look like tomorrow or in 35 years. Where I live, after every hurricane, we can't drink the water because the water's contaminated. Every time we go fishing, we have to throw the fish back because the fish and the water are contaminated. The city banks keep funding these fossil fuel industries in our communities. They put them in the small black and indigenous communities on purpose because they know that we can't do anything about that. They put them in poor communities, in low-income communities on purpose. This is not okay. This is racist. I'm not even a teenager yet, and I have to fight for my life and many others my age. I shouldn't have to do this. This is not right.
We will continue.
We will continue
to shut down this building.
Until Citibank
stops funding fossil fuels. Please welcome Jerry, who came all the way from the Philippines.
I came here for the Climate Week. Since a heat wave in summer. That has devastated 120 provinces and cities in my country. With 120 Fahrenheit degrees, which we haven't experienced historically. This is what city is doing to all of us.
My name is Kazi Fauziak. Recent time you see the flooding in Bangladesh. 200,000 people are displaced from their home. This is the corporation responsible for the climate disaster. They invest everything to disaster. They invest, destroy our land, our home.
My name is Sue Page. I'm from Surfside Beach, Texas. I'm with Better Brazoria. We are on the Gulf Coast of Texas. I'm standing in front of Citibank because there is a company that they help to finance called Enterprise. And what happens is they are going to build one pipeline through a seaport oil terminal. There's actually two pipelines proposed going through my area. So we will be able to shut it down if Citibank would stop funding this endeavor.
Some of the voices from Monday's Citibank protests that kicked off Climate Week here in New York City alongside the UN General Assembly. Today, President Biden is addressing the UN General Assembly and will be speaking at another event about his climate accomplishments. For more, we're joined by Kumi Naidu, longtime South African human rights and environmental justice activist, former head of Greenpeace International, also former head of Amnesty International, now the president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. Can you lay out what this Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty is all about and what you're doing, Kumi?
So the first time I met you, Amy, was at the Copenhagen Climate Summit in 2009, where you'll remember we were calling for a fab deal, not a fabulous deal, but a fair, ambitious, and binding deal in 2009. What we got was a flab deal full of loopholes and BS. And what we have seen is, important though the COP is to get us in the right direction, that when you have the kind of domination by fossil fuel lobbyists and so on in the COP, where they've managed to somehow keep the term fossil fuels off any COP declaration and so on, we have to now recognize that we need something complementary. And I think the effort made by Sipora Berman, the founder of the treaty, and the wonderful team that she's assembled is exactly what we need, which is we need to have a legal instrument that ensures that governments can comply. Right now, it's sort of voluntary, right? They can agree things in COP and they can walk away on it the next day. So we are starting a process. There's already 13 countries on board. The exciting thing is already Colombia and Timor-Leste, two fossil fuel exporting countries, are already on board. And we feel quite confident that as more and more extreme weather events happen on a day-to-day basis virtually around the world, that citizens are rising in a way that we will push our leaders to actually come together and get a global agreement to phase out completely and eradicate fossil fuels from our economic system.
And Kumi, you mentioned Colombia. Could you talk about what is going on in terms of movements in Latin America, the Colombia becoming the first nation to join the coalition?
So what we are seeing is that the most vulnerable countries in the world and those that are in the front line of climate impacts are the ones that actually are the first movers. And basically, once we have a critical mass, we can start the conversations towards the content of the treaty. Just to be clear to all governments, the treaty does not exist. This is about creating a process that will give us the binding outcome where hopefully we can hold our leaders account. So with the Colombia, we applaud their leadership, and we hope that other fossil fuel producing countries in the global south will also see that it's in their long-term interest not to continue their addiction to a poison, which is oil, coal, and gas, that is killing our children and their children's futures.
And could you name names, talk about some of the nations and corporations that are profiting the most from fossil fuel extraction now, even while their words may say something differently?
Oh, that list, sadly, one is very long. So let me just say that there's double speak here, right? Because the thing is, we have won the argument, and we won the argument several years ago in the sense that not a single nation in the world says that the climate science is not urgent and real. Not a single fossil fuel company in the world denies the climate science as they were doing in the past and putting a lot of hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in lies and misinformation, confusing people. Where the big difference is about the pace of the phase out. Fossil fuel companies and some of the governments that they dominate would like to drag it out, it would seem, right till the end of the century when the science says we are running out of time and we need to do it now. So the fight is for the urgency and the fastest withdrawal. And of course, the most powerful nations in the world, Russia, China, United States, and so on, say one thing about the urgency, but in actual practice are actually nowhere near what the science tells us we need to do.
Kumi Naidoo, in a press briefing yesterday, you compared the fossil fuel industry with the industry of slavery. Explain.
So firstly, both industries were legal, right? The fossil fuel industry is legal. The slave industry was legal. Secondly, both are absolutely morally repugnant, right? The slavery was one of the worst atrocities committed by human beings on human beings. Fossil fuel addiction, its impact threatens the very existence of our children's future. So the scale of the immorality of our dependence on oil, coal, and gas when we have alternatives and we can move decisively over the next decades to get off it. But the commonality is also that they have exceptional arrogance, they have exceptional, both industries, they have exceptional control over political decision makers in several countries, and both industries behave with absolute impunity. Do you know that as we sit here today, slave owners in the UK still get compensation, their families still get compensation for the loss of their slaves, right? No compensation to the people under slavery, who suffered under slavery. So bottom line is both the industries are immoral, unethical, and so on. And we need to start treating the CEOs of fossil fuel companies as slave owners with the same kind of resistance that we saw to bring an end to slavery.
The COP, the UN Climate Summit, will be in Baku, Azerbaijan, yet another petrostate. Last year, it was the UAE. Can you talk about the significance of this and also talk about the role of the United States? We're in a historic election year. What difference what the U.S. does makes?
So firstly, you know, if the COP, which you and I have been to multiple times, didn't exist, we would have to create it. But let's be very clear that it's not the best, most equitable, most inclusive negotiating forum. One of the reasons we have had the term fossil fuels, which is the most direct impact on climate change, the most devastating impact kept off the agenda, is because consistently the largest delegations to the COPs is actually the fossil fuel industry. So if you take Glasgow, for example, UK, because it was in the UK, at about 300 delegates. When you combine the fossil fuel lobbyists, they are about 5,000. I mean, just try to imagine that. That is like Alcoholics Anonymous, an organization that does immensely good work and supports people around the world, having their national conference, and the largest delegation to that conference is the alcohol industry, right? The absurdity of it must be addressed. So then when you ask about the U.S., obviously in the U.S., we got a stark choice. You got the Republican Party, which basically in fact, it's about the only political party I know in the world right now that actually denies the science and whose leader actually, in a blatant way says, we're going to drive fossil fuel production, drill, baby, drill. So I guess it's not to say that the Democrats are anywhere near what we need them to be, because they say the right things, but we still see they are open to fossil fuel infrastructure being built and so on. So from an activism point of view, whoever gets elected, obviously the Democrats would be a easier fight for us, because while they're not where we need them to be, they are much closer to what we actually need from our politicians right now.
We only have, like, 30 seconds, but we just played a clip of Greta Thunberg, who was making the link between Chevron and Gaza. When she was just a climate activist, I won't say just a just climate activist, she was covered all over the world and in the United States. In the United States, you almost never see her now talking about Gaza. You're South African. South Africa's brought that case to the International Court of Justice of genocide against Israel. Your quick comments linking the anti-war movement and the climate justice movement.
We have to recognize many of the struggles we face are very intersecting and very connected. The fact that Greta and other voices who see no contradiction between standing up against genocide on the one end and standing up for an ecocide that we are experiencing as a result of climate change, there shouldn't be a contradiction between the two. And it is sad that, in fact, the media environment, which in the United States, for example, claims to be democratic and open and so on, engages in such censorship around the contradictions that we exist. Because, you know, occupation in Ukraine is completely accepted. Occupation in Palestine is treated in completely different ways by the media, and that should change.
Kumi Naidu, South African human rights and environmental justice activist, president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. Next up, unless the U.S. Supreme Court intervenes, Missouri is set to kill Marcellus Williams tonight, despite the fact that the jurors, the prosecutor, and the murder victim's family all oppose his execution. Back in 15 seconds. Oh, Song of the Sleeping Forest by Susumu Yokota. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Unless the U.S. Supreme Court intervenes, the state of Missouri will kill Marcellus Williams at 6 p.m. Central Time today. On Monday, Republican Governor Mike Parson turned down Williams' bid for clemency, followed a short time later by the Missouri Supreme Court rejecting his latest legal challenge. Williams is African-American. He was convicted in 2001 of killing a former St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporter, Leisha Gale, who's white, during a robbery. He was convicted by 11 white jurors and one black juror after the prosecution was allowed to preemptively strike out six other prospective black jurors. Williams always maintained his innocence. The jurors, the prosecutor, and the murder victim's family all oppose Williams' execution. For more, we're joined in Kansas City, Missouri, by Tricia Rojo Bushnell, Marcellus Williams' attorney, executive director of the Midwest Innocence Project. Welcome to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes, but it's possible that Marcellus Williams only has a few hours. Can you explain what you are calling for and what this case at the last minute is all about?
Yes, at this time, we're asking for what Marcellus Williams has been asking for 23 years, which is for a court to take a full and accurate review of the proceedings before it. Right now, for the first time ever, a few weeks ago, the prosecutor had to take the stand and testify under oath about his strikes that he used during the jury selection process. And at that hearing, he testified that he, at least in part, struck a juror based on his race. Yet right now, we have yet to have a court who will fully examine and review that evidence. We know that that's a violation of the Constitution. The prosecutor agrees that violated Williams' constitutional rights. But what we see is a system that's looking at finality over fairness, rushing to get to an execution date instead of taking the time to stop this execution and look at the merits of what is being argued.
And what was the main evidence against him? And could you talk about the advanced DNA testing and what it's revealed about the murder weapon?
Yes. So Mr. Williams was convicted based on what we know is a leading cause of wrongful conviction, which is essentially informant testimony. So this is a murder where there were no leads for months and months. And then at some point, the police suggested to the victim's husband that he should offer a reward. And it was only then, after a $10,000 reward had been offered, that the first informant came forward, a jailhouse informant, who said also that he wouldn't testify until he got the money. The information he provided was information that was essentially out in the public sphere from the newspaper. But he also provided information about another informant, a woman named Laura Asaro, who had had connections to Marcellus Williams in the past. She also not only had incentivized by the reward money, but the police forced her to talk by picking her up on her own warrants and saying, you know, we can arrest you and charge you with these crimes unless you help us here. At the time of the crime, there was a number of pieces of forensic evidence, including bloody footprints and hairs found at the crime scene, all of which exclude Marcellus Williams. In 2015, however, Mr. Williams requested additional DNA testing of the murder weapon, which was a knife found still protruding from the victim's body. That DNA testing was performed, male DNA was found on that murder weapon, and it excludes Marcellus Williams. He is not the person who left that DNA on the knife. Based on all of that evidence, the prosecutor reviewed the case, brought forward this motion to overturn Mr. Williams' conviction on the basis of innocence, as well as on the basis of these constitutional violations, including racial discrimination. But on the day before the evidentiary hearing, new DNA testing came in that showed that the DNA on that knife could be consistent with the trial prosecutor's DNA and the trial prosecutor's investigator. At the evidentiary hearing, we've now learned that they mishandled that knife. They touched it without gloves in 2001 repeatedly, essentially destroying any potential probative value this critical evidence would have, which is what the prosecutor now also concedes was a constitutional violation.
So, Tricia, who is in charge at the U.S. Supreme Court of this case? What has to happen today?
So the stay motions go to Justice Kavanaugh, but the courts are going to be reviewing all of the cert petitions, the requests that the Supreme Court take on the case, as well as the motions to stop the execution. There are three petitions pending before the U.S. Supreme Court right now. The first is regarding the governor, Parson, had dissolved what was called a board of inquiry that was created to review all of this evidence. He dissolved it, even though Governor Eric Greitens had appointed it. So the first is regards to whether or not he was able to do that. The second is whether the federal court should have reopened the case to allow this new evidence of racial discrimination in the jury selection to be heard. And the last one filed last night is about what weight should the prosecutor be given, his concessions be given. And we know that the U.S. Supreme Court has already granted review of a similar case, the case of Richard Glossop out of Oklahoma, where the attorney general said the same thing, that, you know, the constitutional error occurred here and we shouldn't execute him. And so for those same reasons, the court should hear this case.
Tricia
as well.
Rojo Bushnell, executive director of the Midwest Innocence Project, the prosecutor, the jurors and the victim's family have called for him not to be executed. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Two out of three geese, six out of seven seagulls, and this Transylvanian owl all agree that if they had their own radios, they would tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting just for you from Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
For 50 years, the Banree Foundation has supported the continuing education of women at Queen's. Join Banree for its 50th anniversary gala on October 24th at 7 p.m. at the Isabel Bader Center for the Performance.